fantastic people. But there was an aim to his wandering, a purpose, as there was to everything he did. He had learned many of life's lessons in the past year and now hoped to expand his understanding of the nature of the world even more by attending a college. He heard of a city called Auburn, where such a college existed. It was to this town he traveled. He arrived there of an evening, tired and hungry, and found a room in the home of an old woman who took in boarders. She fed him and gave him a bed in which to rest. He slept for 3 days and three nights, and when he awoke, felt strong again, clear in mind and body. Thereupon he thanked the old woman for her assistance, and in return offered to help her in any way he could. Well, it so happened the old woman had only one eye. The other eye, which was made of glass, she took out every night and soaked in a cup of water on the nightstand beside her bed. And it so happened that, some days before my father arrived, a group of youths had broken into the old woman's home and stolen her eye. So she told my father that she would be grateful if he could but find her eye and return it to her. My father made a vow then and there that he would do it. And he left her home in search of the eye that very morning. The day was cool and bright, and my father full of hope. The city of Auburn was named after a poem, and it was at that time a great center of learning. Young people eager to know the secrets of the world crowded into small classrooms, alert to the words of the peripatetic professor before them. This is where Edward longed to be. On the other hand, many came there merely to fool around, and organized in large groups for this purpose alone. It didn't take long for my father to learn that it was one of these groups that had broken into the old woman's home and stolen her eye. Indeed, the eye had become the focus of some notoriety, and was discussed openly and with great veneration among certain individuals Edward Bloom shrewdly befriended. It was said the eye had magic powers. It was said the eye could see. It was said to be bad luck to look directly into the eye, for the old woman would know you then. And on a dark night she would hunt you down and find you, and then she would do unspeakable things to you. The eye never stayed in the same place twice. Each night it was given to a different boy as a rite of initiation. It was the boy's duty to see that no harm came to the eye. All that night, the boy possessing the eye wasn't allowed to sleep. He could only watch the eye. The eye was wrapped in a soft red cloth, and the cloth was placed inside a small wooden box. In the morning, the eye was returned to the leader of the group, who asked the boy questions and who examined the eye and then sent him on his way. All this Edward learned in a short time. In order to return the eye to the old woman, Edward realized he would have to become one of the boys who possessed it for the night. This is what he sought to do. Edward expressed his desire to become one of the boys to a new friend, and after a moment of circumspection, was told to come alone to a barn some miles in the country that very night. The barn was dark and crumbling, and the door creaked spookily as he pushed it open. Light from candles hung from black iron holders played on the barn walls, and shadows danced in the corners. Six human figures sat in a semicircle toward the back of the barn, and all were wearing dark brown hoods, which appeared to have been made out of burlap. On a small table before them was the old lady's eye. It rested like a jewel on top of a red silken pillow. Edward approached them fearlessly.
"Welcome," said the one in the middle. "Please be seated."
"But whatever you do," said another quite ominously, "don't look into the eye."
My father sat on the ground and waited in silence. He did not look into the eye. After a moment, the one in the middle spoke again.
"Why are you here?" he asked.
"The eye," Edward said. "I've come for the eye."
"The eye has called you here, has it not?" he said. "Have you not heard the eye calling for you?"
"I have," Edward said. "I have heard the eye call to me."
Then take the eye and place it in the box, and stay with it all through the night and return it here on the morrow, should anything happen to the eye.
But the one in the middle stopped speaking, and there arose a mournful murmur from the others.
Should anything happen to the eye, he said again, if it becomes lost or broken.
But here he stopped again and stared at my father through the slits in his hood.
Then we shall take one of your eyes as recompense, he said.
The six hoods nodded as one.
I see,
my father said, unacquainted with this rather serious stipulation until now.
On the morrow, then, he said.
Yes, said my father, the morrow.
Leaving the barn and entering into the dark country night, Edward walked toward the lights of Auburn, deep in thought. He didn't know what to do. Would they truly take one of his own eyes if he failed to return the glass one tomorrow? Stranger things have happened. Clutching the box in his right hand as he walked, he touched his eyes with his left hand, each of them, and wondered what it would be like if one of them were gone, and if, indeed, his vow to the old lady should be honored when so much was at stake. He knew it was possible that the figures in the hoods had no intention of taking one of his eyes, and yet, if there was but a 10% chance, even a 1% chance that this would happen, was it all worth it? His eyes were real, after all, and the old woman's eye just made of glass. He stayed up with the eye all night, staring into its shiny blueness, seeing himself within it, until the sun, rising above the tree line the next morning, seemed to him to be the shining eye of some forgotten god. The barn looked different in the light of day, not so scary. Just an old barn with missing slats, hay poking through holes like stuffing out a pillow. Cows chewing on the grass, an old brown horse fenced in nearby, nose full of air. Edward hesitated at the barn door, then pushed it open. Its creakiness not so spooky now.
You're late, someone said.
Edward looked to the back of the barn, but there were no hooded figures this time. Just six college boys, roughly as old as Edward was, dressed about the same. Loafers, khaki trousers, light blue button-down cotton shirts.
You're late, he said again.
And Edward recognized the voice from the night before. He was the one in the middle, the leader. Edward looked at him for a long moment.
Sorry, Edward said. There was somebody I had to see.
Do you have the eye? He asked him.
Yes, Edward said. The eye is here.
The man pointed to the small box Edward clutched in his hand.
Give it here, then, he said.
Edward gave the man the box, and as the others crowded around to see, he opened it. They stared into the box for what seemed a long time. Then all of them turned to Edward.
It's not here, the leader said, almost in a whisper, his face turning red with fury. The eye's not here, he screamed.
All at once they came for him, until Edward raised his hand and said, I told you the eye was here. I didn't say it was in the box. The six boys stopped, fearing the eye was somewhere on my father's person, and that if they were to beat him badly, they might end up hurting the eye as well.
Give it over, the leader said. You have no right. That eye belongs to us.
Does it?
It was then the barn door creaked feebly open, and all turned to watch as the old lady, her eye newly restored, came toward them. The six stared, uncomprehending.
What?
One said, turning to the others.
Who?
The eye, my father said. I told you it was here.
And as the old lady drew near, they could see that it was here indeed. Not in the box, but back in the old lady's head. And though they would have run, they couldn't. And though they would have turned away, they couldn't. And as she looked at each of them in turn stared deeply into the old lady's eye. And it was said that within the eye, each of them could see their future.
and one screamed at what he saw there, and one cried, but one merely looked deeply into the eye, uncomprehending, then looked up at my father and stared, as if he knew him now in a different way. Finally, she was done, and all of them ran out of the barn door and into the bright morning. Thus Edward's short stay in Auburn began, and he was rarely ever bothered by anybody, for he was thought to be under the protection of the old lady and her all-seeing eye. He began attending classes and became an A student. He had a good memory. He remembered everything he read, everything he saw, and he remembered the face of the leader in the barn that day, just as the leader would remember Edward's. It was the face of the man my mother almost married. My father's death, take two. It happens like this. Old Dr. Bennett, our family doctor, comes out of the guest room and gently shuts the door behind him. Older than old, he looks like the core of an apple left out in the sun. He was there when I was born, and he was old even then. My mother and I are sitting in the living room, waiting for his word. Removing the stethoscope from his ears, he looks hopelessly at us. He says,
"There's nothing I can do. I'm sorry. If you have any peace to make with Edward, anything to say at all, now might be..." And he trails off into a murmuring silence. This is something we'd been expecting, this final observation. My mother and I sigh. There's both sadness and relief in the way the tension leaves our bodies, and we look at each other, sharing that look, that once-in-a-lifetime look. I'm a little surprised that the day has finally come, for even though Dr. Bennett had given him a year to live about a year ago, he has been dying so long that in a way I just expect him to keep on dying forever. "Maybe I should go in first," she says. She looks battered, war-weary, her smile lifeless and somehow serene. "Unless you want to." "No," I say. "You go, and then..." "If anything..." "Fine," I say. "Just let me know." She takes a breath, stands, walks like a somnambulist into his room, leaving the door open behind her. Dr. Bennett, slightly hunched as though his bones have melted in his old age, stands at vacant attention in the middle of the living room, in dark amazement at the powers of life and death. After a few minutes, my mother returns, wipes a tear from her cheek, and gives Dr. Bennett a hug. He has known her longer than I have, I think. She's old, too, but next to him, she seems forever young. She seems a young woman about to become a widow.
"William," she says.
And so I go in. The room is dim, the grayness of an afternoon nap, though beyond the curtains you can see the outside light bursting to come in. This is the guest room. This is where some of my friends stayed when they used to spend the night, before high school was over and all that. And now it's the room where my father is dying. Nearly dead. When I come in, he smiles. Dying, he has that look dying people get in their eyes sometimes. Happy and sad. Tired and spiritually blessed all at the same time. I've seen it on television. When the main character dies, he stays buoyant until the end, dispensing advice to loved ones in his weakening voice, being falsely optimistic about his terminal prognosis, and generally making people cry because he's taking things so well. But it's different with my father. He isn't buoyant or falsely hopeful at all. In fact, he's fond of saying, "Why am I still alive? I feel like I should have died a long time ago." He looks like it, too. His barely over-middle-aged body looks as if it has been dug up out of the ground and resuscitated for another go at it. And though he's never had much hair in the first place, he was an old pro at the comb-over, what little hair he did have is gone, and his skin color is a weird shade of true white. So that when I look at him, the word that comes to mind is curdled. My dad has curdled.
"You know," he says to me that day. You know what I'd like?
What's that, Dad?
A glass of water, he says. A glass of water would really hit the spot about now.
Done, I say, and I bring him a glass of water, which he takes shakily to his lips, dribbling some down his chin, and looking up at me with those eyes as if to say he could have lived a long life, or a longer life anyway than he is going to live, without me having to see him dribble water down his chin.
Sorry, he says.
Don't worry about it, I say. You didn't spill that much.
Not about that, he says, and he shoots me a painful gaze.
Well, apology accepted, I say. But you know, you've been a real trooper through this whole thing. Mom and I are real proud of you. To which he doesn't say anything, because even though he is dying, he's still my father, and he doesn't appreciate being spoken to like a schoolboy. In the past year, we've switched places. I've become the father and he the sickly son, whose comportment under these extreme circumstances I value.
Oh, boy, he says wearily, as if he has been knocked in the head. What were we just talking about?
Water, I say, and he nods, remembering, and takes another sip. Then he smiles. What's so funny? I say.
I was just thinking, he says, that I'll be getting out of this guest room just in time for guests.
He laughs, or does what passes for a laugh these days, what amounts to an exerted wheeze. It had been his decision to move to the guest room some time ago. Although he'd wanted to die at home with us, he hadn't wanted to die in the bedroom he and Mom had shared for the past few decades, insomuch as he felt it might ruin things for her in the future. Dying and moving out of the guest room just in time for an out-of-town relative attending his funeral, to use it, is a witticism he has repeated a dozen times in the last few weeks, each time as if it has just come to him. Which it has, I suppose. He tells it with the same freshness every time, and I can't help but smile at the effort. And so we're stuck here, smiles on our faces like a couple of idiots. What is it you say now? What peace is there to be made in the last minutes of the last day that will mark the before and after of your life until then? The day that will change everything for both of you, the living and the dead. It's 3:10 in the afternoon. Outside, it's summer. This morning I'd made plans to go to a movie later in the evening with a friend home from college. My mother is making an eggplant casserole for dinner. She's already laid out the ingredients on the kitchen counter. Before Dr. Bennett came out with his news, I decided to go out back and jump in the pool, which, until recently, my father has practically lived in, swimming being the only exercise he was capable of. The swimming pool is right outside the guest room window. Mother thinks my swimming keeps him awake sometimes, but he likes to hear me swimming. The splashing, he says, makes him feel a little wet himself. Slowly, we lose our idiot smiles and just look at each other plainly.
Hey, my father says, I'll miss you.
And me you.
Really? He says.
Of course, Dad.
I'm the one still here, he says. So it figures that you'd be the one doing the missing.
Do you, I say, as if the words are being willed by a force inside of me, do you believe? I stop myself. There's an unspoken rule in my family that it's best not to talk religion or politics with my father. When the subject is religion, he won't talk at all, and when it's politics, he won't stop talking. The truth is, most things are hard to talk about with him. By that I mean the essence of things, the important things, the things that matter. Somehow, it's just too hard for him, and maybe a bit dicey. A chore for this very intelligent man who has forgotten more facts about geography and math and history than I've ever learned. He knew the capital of all 50 states and where you'd end up if you flew due east from New York. So I edit my thoughts as much as I can. But sometimes
A few indelicate words escape.
Believe what?